Well, hello out there in podcast land, and welcome back to the Front Row Network of Podcasts, a member of the Community Voices of NPR Illinois. I'm your host for this episode, Lou Hare, and you might be hearing this on a multiple feeds. I don't know if we've ever had a trifecta. I think we've had some crossovers, but I don't know if we've ever been able to talk about a movie that qualifies as both a guilty pleasure, a full disclosure, and a flashback, and yet somehow we're pulling the hat trick tonight, because we are going to be talking about Mario Puzo's The Godfather Coda, The Death of Michael Corleone. Now, for those of you who are not familiar with what that is it is a reworked version of The Godfather Part 3, which we discussed on Guilty Pleasures earlier, I believe in November. And joining me to talk about it is a gentleman who joined me on the Godfather 3 podcast, as well as the Godfather 2 and the Godfather 1 podcast. So here we are, finally, much like the Godfather saga itself, limping to its finish. Please welcome Mr. Brandon Davis. How's it going, Brandon?
Hey, Lou. How's it going?
It's good.
And it all comes down to this. I don't foresee any other Godfather podcasts in the future.
I think we are officially putting the Godfather saga to bed with this one. I don't think there's no Godfather 4. There's no recuts of anything else. You know, I guess if we really run out of content, we'll someday maybe go back and cover the chronological cut that Coppola did. But who we got?
There's too much content.
I don't think we're not ready for that. But yeah, so yeah, I'm excited to talk about this because it's rare that we ever see something like this happen. You know, we hear about director's cuts all the time, and we hear about our producer's cuts or revisits. I think there's like 16 different versions of Blade Runner out there, each one the definitive version. But this is a really interesting case of Francis Ford Coppola, 30 years later, revisiting a movie that clearly still means something to him. And I think there's also maybe a chance for redemption, much like Michael is seeking redemption in The Godfather Part 3, to go back and revisit this, add some things, recut some things and reshuffle. And so here we are with this brand new version of The Godfather Part 3. Now, I'm going to call this Godfather Part 3 right off the bat, because first of all, let's just, the official title is Mario Puzo's The Godfather, Coda, The Death of Michael Corleone, which is just a feast for punctuation lovers everywhere. But aside from that, maybe not the most elegant title. So what we're going to do is, if you have already heard our podcast on The Godfather Part 3, or if you haven't, you can go back and listen to that. We're not going to do a deep dive into the film itself, because we've already covered that. And there's only so many times we can talk about incest and diabetes. But although we'll probably still have to touch on them a little bit here.
They're still there, unfortunately.
Yep, still there. What we're going to do on this episode is we're going to focus just solely on the changes that were made, which ones we liked, which ones we didn't like, and then maybe discuss which version we would prefer, which version we think is the definitive version of The Godfather Part 3. So, Brandon, just to start off, what were your first impressions of The Godfather Coda, The Death of Michael Corleone?
I gotta say, I'm not usually a fan of these recuts. I think they're mostly just cash grabs, but I gotta say, this is an improvement. I was very shocked. From the moment it starts, it actually kind of felt like something separate from the other two. I think that Part 3, when it was originally released, was trying too much to tie into the other two movies. And now Coppola has finally said, okay, this is going to exist on its own. And I think it works to its benefit. Now, there's still gaping flaws that are baked into the whole recipe here. But I think overall, this is a much tighter, cleaner package.
Yeah, I agree with you. I really, I enjoyed this watch. I really did, and I was kind of surprised at you know, I think like you, I'm skeptical of director's cuts and unrated versions where they add an extra scene in here or there. But it's clear that this was a thoughtful reorganization of a film. You know, there's no new footage here. There's no, you know, they didn't go shoot some new things. But you know, it's just in its own way, it's an interesting lesson in how much editing really impacts a film. If you have 6 hours of your life and you want to learn a little bit about how editing really can change a film, you could watch these two back to back and see. And I think, as you pointed out, Brandon, this is definitely an upgrade. Now, we're upgrading from The Godfather Part 3, so we're not necessarily tinkering with Blade Runner here, but the fact that it's better or more watchable, I think, is a win.
I think that, I don't know. And we'll certainly talk about one of the major changes, which is the opening scene, but just changing that one thing made the movie make more sense in a way. I think that the whole first half hour of the original cut of Part 3 drags its feet way too much. Mm-hmm. And it takes forever to get into the action. You don't meet the character of Vincent right away, and you meet him very quickly in this, and you get right into the action. So there is an economy of storytelling that was not part of the first one.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, let's get there. Mm-hmm. And talk about the first major change, the first change you'll see. And again, spoilers, but if you know, really, if you're listening to this, you're probably just interested to hear is like, hey, what did they change, in case you didn't want to devote 2.5 hours? We will not devote 2.5 hours talking to you about this movie. We're going to keep this short like an actual coda. But I digress. I'm going to stop beating up on him for that title at some point. I don't know when, but
it's still too long to be a coda.
Still, yeah, exactly. But yeah, so the biggest change that you see right up front is, the opening scene has changed. We are opening now, instead of the previous version opened with basically a flashback to the end of Godfather Part 2, and then Michael's letter to his daughter about coming to this giant party. Instead, what we get here is we get the opening with Michael Corleone hearing about the Immobiliare deal from
Father Gildray or something like that.
Yes. Yeah. So, which again, maybe that's a slight to the film about, you know, I've seen this movie twice in a month now, and I still can't remember that.
Remember the last podcast when I said all the supporting characters kind of just go through you like air?
Yep. And still does. So we open with that scene where he is speaking with that character and talking about the Immobiliare deal, and it harkens back to the first scene of the first Godfather with Marlon Brando, with Vito Corleone talking to Bonasera and asking for his help on something. And so it calls back to the first one, but then what it does is it really sets up the plot of the film, which in the original cut, this scene happens, I think, 40, 45 minutes into the film. And as you pointed out, Brandon, before we get that, we get this kind of meandering party scene, which I get is a callback to the first two films, but nowhere near as effective.
Yeah, because in the first movie, you don't even know his relationship with the Vatican at the beginning when all this is going on. You just know that he's being honored by the Vatican, mm-hmm. and it takes forever to get to the point. Mm-hmm. And what I really like about this is, you know, we praised the last time the opening few sections of The Godfather 3 because it harkened back to Part 2. Mm-hmm. But I think taking that out, it sort of just drops you back in. It's like you haven't seen these people in 20 years. Now you're just being dropped right back into the action. And now you're having to catch up to where they are. You're not having to sort of being reintroduced to everybody all along.
Yeah. And you're not being reminded of a superior film.
Right.
Which I think is one of the things we talked about on the podcast, was like the highlights of Godfather 3 were the clips from Godfather 2. And that was a slight. And yeah, I think in general, so that's something that was taken out of the film. All of those flashbacks or callbacks are gone.
Right.
We don't really hear Michael even mention Fredo's name until the diabetes episode, which that hasn't left the film. That's still there. And then towards the end when he's confessing his sins, and it feels like more of a powerful reveal at that moment. So instead of feeling like, you know, we said this on the last podcast, but I felt like the original cut of The Godfather Part Three, you feel like you're just watching Michael wallow for three hours. And I didn't get that in this one. It's something we learn in the third act. It's like, oh, he is carrying this around, and that's why he's wanting this redemption.
Right. Yeah. And I think that, I don't know, for some reason, Pacino's performance felt a little fresher to me this time around. And I think it's because we don't, as you mentioned, we don't see him wallow as much. But I think because we're dropped right into the action, he seems much more of a aggressive player than passive, the way he comes off toward most of the first act of Part Three.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And so that drops us into the action. Now we still get the party scene, which I do believe was trimmed down. It's not nearly as, or at least if it's not as long, it didn't feel as long. It's hard to go, you know, frame by frame, like it's the Zapruder film or something to know exactly what, you know, what was trimmed here and there. But overall, yeah, this film is 10 minutes shorter than the cut that's on Blu-ray right now. I believe it's, you know, it's only like 4 minutes shorter than the theatrical release, but you can't get the theatrical release anywhere.
True.
You just get this version. So yeah, it's, I mean, and so yeah, you're cutting out little bits here and there, and that adds up over time. So yeah, it moves swiftly. Yeah, we get introduced to Vincent a lot sooner. And then we get to kind of spread things out a little bit, and the whole thing just has kind of a forward motion to it. And yeah, it's really kind of interesting to see how just the moving of one scene from one spot of the film to the other really does add a clarity, as you pointed out.
And I never felt watching the original cut of Part Three that you needed the whole coronation ceremony, and people refer to it in exposition, and I think that's just fine. And once again, like I said, the introduction of Andy Garcia much quicker into the action makes you feel like he's an important player this time around, where they really took their time in bringing him in and just a few little quick exposition shots, but this time he's right into the action, and yeah, things move quick, and you're introduced to Don Antebello a lot quicker, and there's a lot of these newer characters get thrown in right away instead of taking their time, you know. And I'd have to put like two TVs up and watch them both side by side, but I feel like we get less George Hamilton in this one, which I'm okay with. But
yeah, I think so too, because I think his exposition clarifies the plot, but the plot, since the plot has been clarified, I think they can trim some of that. And, you know, you do see some of those characters minimized a little bit. And I think, you know, some of the two more egregious casting choices is one, George Hamilton in place of Robert Duvall, and Sofia Coppola. And in Hamilton's case, they really minimize him. And in Sofia Coppola's case, she still has to be a main character in the story. But I also feel like some of her scenes may have been tightened up a little bit as well, or at least spaced out throughout the course of the film, because I felt similarly about Sofia Coppola, that it feels like you don't see her as much, or she's not as out in front as she is in the original cut.
Yeah, and because of that, she doesn't hover over the movie like a dark cloud anymore. I feel like she's peppered in when she's needed. And in many ways, you know, even though I called BS on Coppola saying she felt natural and fresh in the movie, she does feel less, she doesn't stand out as much this time around. I feel like she's much better incorporated, and, you know, the sins of her, you know, unable to act as well as some of the other people on screen don't show quite as much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree. You know, yeah, she, you know, you can't edit someone into, I mean, maybe you can in certain cases, you can't edit somebody into a better performance when they're not ready to give, you know, that kind of level of performance. And again, we're not going to go, you know, air old grievances about the first film, but in terms of minimizing some of the big flaws of the film, I would agree. I think her dialogue delivery still wouldn't. Yes. However, as you pointed out, you know, the moments are so fleeting, or the scenes are so tightened that you're not left with these long passages of being like, oh my gosh, how much longer do I have to sit with this character? And so, yeah, I think that was, that ended up being a good choice. And cause clearly you can't excise her from the story altogether. And, you know, she's still a focal point, which I guess that's one of the big changes or one of the big things we should say that has not changed about the film is the relationship between Sofia Coppola's character and Andy Garcia's character.
Right. And, you know, it's still, you know, to me, that's still the most cringeworthy aspect of it. We still get a lot of those uncomfortable scenes, you know, too bad Eric's not here to lament about that one scene from the last time. It's still there in all its glory. Mm-hmm. But that's just an unfortunate part of the script, and you can't necessarily edit out, you know, a plot point to the script. Mm-hmm. But it's, you know, it is what it is. Like I said, that's probably the biggest flaw that's still baked into this, you know, whole recipe. But to me, there's less gaping flaws in this version. You know, I'll deal with this one big one, you know, for a better whole that we have now. But one thing I noticed aside from the plot line, though, you know, we still get, you know, Diane Keaton is still underutilized, in my opinion. And also, I didn't mention this the first time around, but Bridget Fonda makes such an impression in her first couple of scenes, and then that character just disappears altogether. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, you went to the trouble of creating this character, and you have Bridget Fonda in there, and she's really good in the few scenes that she's in, and then you just waste her. I know she probably wasn't, you know, a huge name yet, but she's got the last name Fonda. You could have taken advantage of that.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, yeah, her character serves next to no purpose. Oh. She doesn't forward the action of the story at all. But, you know, even that little sequence, I think it's jarring after the fact because Bridget Fonda, you know, would go on to have such a storied career.
Right.
But I think in 1990, she's not, you know, she's as well known of an actress as she would become in the 90s. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that is what it is, I guess. But yeah, so we get those scenes, and then we do see, you know, and again, we can't, you know, go with a fine tooth comb and say every scene was changed, but it does, there were several scenes where time was trimmed down or shown in a little bit of a different order, it felt like, that really kind of gives the film a much tighter focus. And the pacing of the film, that was the one thing that I really took from the film, is at 2.5 hours, it really moves swiftly.
No, it does. We don't get some of these exposition scenes that we can fill in the holes ourselves. Like we don't get the scene where Connie is ordering Vincent to, you know, get Zaza and his men. You know, it just, we see the action and then we just fast forward to Michael saying, don't ever do it, you know, without his orders again. Mm-hmm. And then he reveals that it was Connie that gave the order. And to me, that was more effective anyway, because I think I mentioned in the last one, Connie and Vincent's relationship is so strange. You know, in the first, I don't quite get her attachment. I know he's Sonny's son, but I don't quite get, you know, the attachment and everything. And that took out some of those unnecessary plot points, I feel like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it makes it creates a little bit more of an intrigue.
Yeah.
And it's a sense where, you know, I've said that I think Connie's one of the most interesting aspects of Godfather 3. Mm-hmm. And so to take away a scene feels like, oh, well, you're kind of denying her, but the reveal then actually is more effective.
Right. Right. Yeah. I think I, you know, of, I feel like all of our, you know, original characters are somewhat damaged a little bit in terms of the narrative, except her. I think she comes out the, I think her character has more plus side coming out of part three than the other characters do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And because, as you mentioned, we're introduced to Vincent a lot earlier in the film, his importance is made a lot clearer. It's still hard to watch his original, the incest stuff still there, not going to get rid of that. But yeah, you know, we introduce him as a main character earlier in the film, which makes a lot more sense. And it does what I think was the intent of that opening scene, was to always call back to the original scene, but with the wedding in the first film. But the wedding in the first film is just so elegant in how it introduces all the characters, and each scene, boom, 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 we've introduced new characters within 10, 15 minutes. And in the third one, it takes forever to get there. At this point, that doesn't really happen. To your point, Brandon, the fact that the film is shorter and moves quicker doesn't give us time to dwell as much on the negative aspects of the film.
Right.
And you don't have time to get grossed out over the Noki scene, even though, I mean, it's still there.
Yeah.
Because the forward motion of the movie is a lot more crystallized here.
And because it moves faster, it feels modern, which I feel like, being made in 1990, it should feel more modern. And mm-hmm. and it looks modern because part three, you know, when it was originally released, had the same golden sheen in terms of the cinematography that the first two do. Mm-hmm. But they're taking place, you know, in the 40s, 50s, you know, considered like a golden age. But now we're into the 70s when, you know, things were a lot dirtier, a lot sleazier. It's supposed to look more modern. And I think that helps the movie as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. The removal, and I think I said that on the previous podcast, that gold sheen that the movie has mm-hmm. doesn't work for it at all, because it looks gaudy.
Yeah.
I don't know if the lighting was off or whatever, but whatever they tried and whatever worked in the first two films, it doesn't work in the third one.
So well, and I think it works well because it works well against the backdrop of people, you know, dressed in, you know, 1940s and 50s garb. It looks like it fits. But when you're dressed mm-hmm. in like a more modern 1970s garb, it seems very, yeah, you're right. Gaudy, I think, is the right word for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's, and that, right, even that change alone would be enough to be like, okay, even if it was the exact same film, at least it would be easier on the eyes.
Yeah, absolutely.
And just taking that filter out of it makes a big difference too, and it does give the film the feel that it is a little darker or a little bit more of a subdued film than the first two, mm-hmm. which I know is what Coppola is going for. We'll talk about that in a minute. But he is meaning this to feel more like an epilogue, more like a summing up of the story of Michael Corleone. And of course, we're watching him in kind of like the final act of his life. And so the whole thing does kind of have a more somber tone than the first two films. And I don't necessarily mind that so much, but I like the fact that this now has a look to match that tone.
Yeah. Yeah. It does feel, like I said, you know, the first two movies work very well together as a whole. You know, they're kind of their own, its own separate tale. And now, you know, Coppola is doing, I think, finally what he had intended to do in the first place, to create something that's separate from those. It's the, you know, the same characters, but they're different people and we're different people from where we were when we were, you know, with the first two. So it really kind of, you know, like I said, we're being dropped into a new world of characters that we haven't seen for two decades in time. Mm-hmm. So it really, I think it, you know, the whole new look and the whole new pacing works to its benefit.
Mm-hmm. One scene that also gets cut too, that helps to the story, is that when Michael's in the hospital after that scene where his son says bye to him, we originally get a scene between Michael and Don Altobello, and it's cut in this version. And that kind of allows you to allow his reveal as the big villain a lot more effective as well. Mm-hmm. Now, we, of course, know this as people who had seen the film, so it's not like, you know, completely shocked, but it's just the execution of it. Again, the idea of showing something versus telling something, that scene ended up being, you know, I didn't miss that scene.
No. And I mentioned before in the other podcast, you know, I feel like you have someone of the stature of Eli Wallach, and that character just seems, you know, so... you know, Eli Wallach could play much scarier than what they give him to do. But I think if I were a new viewer coming in, you know, I think that there'd be more of a shock value now seeing, you know, that Connie's godfather and someone who seems just like your own, you know, a genteel grandpa, you know, would turn out to be the villain of the piece. I think that that works to this movie's advantage too.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. And then that gets us, I think, the last big change to talk about is the change of the ending.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's amazing. It really, that he really doesn't change a whole lot. You know, I feel like when we first heard the news of this, it almost felt like Coppola was going to try and give us a whole new, different film almost, but mm-hmm. he really doesn't change all that much. And, you know, it's just a couple of little things that really, you know, make it a better whole. I couldn't believe it.
Yeah. And I think the changes are subtle. You know, he can't reinvent the wheel. He can't throw it all out and start from scratch, but he can tinker with it enough to be like, oh, and I think, you know, who among us hasn't gone back and seen something that we've done and been like, ooh, I could clean that up a little bit. I could tinker with that. I, you know, anybody who's ever, you know, if you ever have written something, you're like, oh, I could have worded that better. Or, you know, if anybody goes back and, you know, I know, you go back and listen to podcasts you recorded, it's like, oh, I could have spoken my ideas a little cleaner. And so, like, I'm all for that. So, you know, it's not a reinvention. It's just a, you know, a reorganization, I think, is almost the best way to put it. So we, and that is typified in the last scene where, again, all we do is we just end the scene a couple seconds earlier. But what that does is, in the original, we see Michael in his in Sicily by himself as an old man. The film ends with him slumping down in his chair and dying. In this film, we are, all we get is the close-up of Michael. He puts on his glasses. We see the shot of him alone by himself, and then we fade out. We don't actually see Michael die. We're left then with a quote. And the final quote is, when the Sicilians wish you centani, it means look for long life, and a Sicilian never forgets. And it's an interesting choice because I think it drives home the fact that this film is called The Death of Michael Corleone. So you assume, oh, we're going to watch him die. But instead, we see a different kind of a death. Because we should, to pull back a minute, they didn't change much in the climax of the film. You know, Mary still gets shot. She still dies. That all happens. And we fast forward then to Michael as an old man, and we see him just having to live out his life alone and in this, the pain that was caused by the death of his daughter, which was his fault.
Yeah, and it's a nice bookend to the end of part two, because we get him sitting by himself alone. So that sort of plays out. But to me, the ending of the original cut just always bothered me, because just seeing him slumped over, first of all, it was filmed awkwardly. and second of all, you know, it just... It put too much of a final button on the thing. And this one leaves you with... it's a much more haunting ending. It leaves you with much more to think about. And, you know, all the great movies leave you with something to think about. So this has an ending, which people will probably talk about and debate now for years to come about what exactly it means.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'll open it up to you. What do you think it means?
Oh, I think that, yeah, well, first of all, I tried to look back to see if that phrase was ever used in a previous Godfather film, and Fredo used it very casually during a dinner scene in part two. But I couldn't think of anything really of substance that was used in one of the other two movies. But I think that, you know, unfortunately, because of Michael's choices, he is, you know, somewhat fated to live a long life because of the choices he's made, but without the love and support of anybody around him. I think that he's just going to kind of, it's interesting how his father, you know, escaped Italy, came to America, built a life, and died surrounded by family and friends. Michael, who grew up in that life of privilege, surrounded by family and friends, now heads back to Italy and dies in solitude in the place where his father fought to get away from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think that's all spot on. I'd agree with all of that. And the fact that, you know, I think I said this in the previous podcast that I would have liked to seen to see how everyone kind of reacts to the death of Mary beyond just that moment.
True.
And the ambiguity a little bit of, does he die? And I think this movie makes it a little cleaner to just drive home the fact that he's just stuck for the rest of his life until he dies. He is alone and tortured with the notion that the one thing he always wanted to do was, he said, everything he did for his family. And it's such a more haunting image or haunting idea to think that he had, you know, we talked about this too, is that we know because of the age makeup that Michael lives for several years beyond the death of Mary.
Right.
What this does is it shows he's going to live even longer than that.
Yes.
And I think the timeline of the film shows 20 years passing, or at least the DVD timeline that's presented in the box set shows a 20-year gap between the death of Mary and the death of Michael in the original cut. Mm-hmm. But now it's like, oh, he could even live longer than that. He's going to spend, you know, 30 years. Who knows? You know, just, right. just this kind of open-ended period of time. Knowing that his daughter died because of him, because he couldn't get out.
I wonder if the intended part four that we might have gotten, I'm sure that that's the time span that it would have focused on. I do wonder, like, if even like Connie would have abandoned him and things like that. I assume she does, because that's what, you know, we're shown. But mm-hmm. like we said, it gives you something to think about and debate now.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And that's way more interesting. It just mm-hmm. More interesting than being served something on a platter that also is kind of underwhelming. It's like, we know Michael's going to die someday, so we don't necessarily need to see him die. But what's more important, and I think the point of the first film, and it's made clearer in this cut, is that it doesn't matter how much longer he lives, he's going to be tormented with this for the rest of his life. That's his actual death.
Yeah.
And that's where, you know, the title, and I know I rag on the title, and I will forever rag on the title, but the death of Michael Corleone, it's like, no, that's the actual death. The death of his, you know, his soul kind of happens in Godfather 2, but this is the death of his heart.
Yeah. And it's a long way from that, you know, idealistic, you know, soldier coming home from World War II that we see in the first movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it really does clean up that whole arc to be like, that's everything that he did. And it then also gives the whole film a sense of tragic content. Obviously the consequences are tragic even in the first film, but you know, this notion of, to draw back to the beginning where he is wanting to get out, and you see him feeling like, okay, he actually maybe has a shot at getting out. Mm-hmm. He might actually do it. But everyone around him is like, no, there's no getting out. This is who you are. And it's him fighting that. And that's a more interesting story of him just being like, okay, I tried it, but the world around me is corrupt. My die was cast a long time ago. And now he has to reap the consequences of that. Yeah. Okay. So are there any other moments or cuts or any changes that we've missed?
I don't think so. I mean, I've read articles about, you know, things being shown from a different angle or whatever, but, you know, I don't know that that makes a whole, you know, big a difference, but I think we focused on mainly the, you know, major plot points that occurred. You know, and you know, the whole helicopter massacre is still there, and I still think it's out of place for a Godfather film. But actually, without the golden sheen there, it actually looks more fitting, because it looks like something out of, you know, the 70s made in the 90s. But yeah, it does feel a little more modern. But yeah, I think all of the changes, you know, exalted a little bit higher than, you know, what it was to begin with.
Yeah, and I guess I should also say that I know I talked about Joey Zaza as a character and not really maybe caring as much for Joe Mantegna's performance, but I also think the restructuring of that first act of the film allows you to maybe not see him as, because he's the first like level of conflict introduced, you think he's going to be a much bigger deal in the film than he ends up being. And because you introduced the Vatican stuff in the first scene, it lets you realize, okay, he's the second tier villain. He's not the actual, like, he's not the actual guy.
Yeah, while, you know, while we are putting more of an emphasis on Andy Garcia in that first scene, we are lessening the emphasis on Joe Mantegna, which is what needed to happen.
Yeah. So, yeah, it again, cleans it up a lot for me. So, you know, I think I know the answer to this question, Brandon, but I guess, you know, I do want to point it out. So if you do, would you consider Mario Puzo's The Godfather, Coda, The Death of Michael Corleone as the definitive version of The Godfather Part 3?
I think so. I you know, if you were a true diehard Godfather fan, which I know you and I are, and there was curiosity and you wanted to see what the original cut was like, sure, go and see it if you want, you know, to, you know, spend another 3 hours watching that. But if you want a satisfying conclusion to these characters and this saga that you have spent so much time with, this tells it in a much more satisfying way.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think not only should anybody who had trepidations about The Godfather Part 3 or hasn't wanted to revisit it, go check this version out. And I think for future viewing, if you've never seen The Godfather Part 3, see this version instead. I think this is a much, now, as you alluded to earlier, Brandon, there are certain things about the film, the fatal flaws that I've always had the biggest problems with can't be changed. No. Robert Duvall is still not there, and his presence is sorely missed. Although, I guess I will say this, though, as we're talking about this, I will never not want Robert Duvall in a movie. But the fact that the focus of the film is less on his family and the mournfulness of Fredo, we had talked about one of the big criticisms of the first film is he's sitting there mourning Fredo and Apollonia in the original cut. Right. And we're like, well, Tom died. You don't seem to care about him. But the fact that we don't get those scenes of Michael ruminating on those two people as much almost kind of allows you to forget that Tom Hagen isn't part of the film.
Yeah.
Not that that makes it, I mean, I still think you'd have had a better film with him in it.
Oh, yeah.
For multiple reasons. And his character deserves a far better conclusion than, you know, the off-screen write-off.
Yeah.
But that part you can't ignore. You really can't edit out the incest. You kind of can't. That's kind of baked in. Could you trim the Noki scene by, you know, 10-15 seconds? Probably. Is it still creepy that they're like 15 years apart from each other? Yeah. So it's not a perfect film, and I think even this version of the doesn't stack up to the first two, but as we said on the last podcast, what does?
Right. But I don't know if it was ever going to meant to be on the same level with them anyway. So, and I think, you know, it's, you know, it, even though it's way too long to be a coda, it is a fitting, it's a fitting coda to that story. So you've got to, I think instead of looking at it as part three, you've just got to look at it as sort of, you know, an appendage to those two movies.
Yes. I would agree with that. I'm still never not going to dunk on that title. And I'm still never going to say, understand how a 2.5 hour movie now is a coda, but you know, hey, to each their own, but I think you do, as long as you go into the film knowing you're not going to get Godfather 1 or Godfather 2,
right,
but you are going to get a much more watchable, faster paced, and satisfying film than we got 30 years ago. And I think one of the interesting things about it is, we talked about this in the last podcast too, about how Coppola didn't really want to do Godfather 3. Mm-hmm. And so I think the years of maybe, and you could call it whatever, maybe it's, you know, him in his older, in his advanced age, maybe it's him, you know, hearing the punchlines for 30 years, maybe just kind of motivated him to have a clearer focus on this version than he did in the first one.
Yeah. And you know, he Coppola is a director who likes to do reduxes of most of his, thank goodness he hasn't touched the first two of these, but he, you know, he messed with Apocalypse Now when he shouldn't have. Mm-hmm. So I'm glad that he, you know, he actually went back and redid a movie he should have done, but I'm sure even though he didn't do it, he's gotten to the point now where, you know, I never wanted to do it, but I might as well make it right finally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'm all for, I'm all for remakes of flawed films.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Go for it. People are like, well, why do you have to go back and do this cut and that cut? You know, I roll my eyes when a good movie gets a director's cut. You know, Almost Famous is one of my favorite films. I've still never seen the 3-hour version of it because I don't need 3 hours of it. Because it was perfect the way it was for me. But will I sit through a possibly better version of Godfather 3? Of course I will. Uh-huh. So yeah. Let's go back. Let's re-edit all these failed projects that could have been better and make them better. I'm all for that.
Yeah.
It's the Ocean's 11 theory. We take a mediocre movie and we reboot it and make it even better.
Yeah, that's true.
So, yeah. So, okay. I think that's going to do it. You know, like we said, we weren't going to do the full, you know, we don't need to do the full deep dive into everything about Godfather 3 because you can catch that now as a companion piece to this one. So yeah. If you want to skip the movies altogether, you can go back and hear our original take on the original cut. Now having heard our take on this version to pair together. See, this being an actual coda. Shorter than the original by a significant margin.
Yeah, and you can go back and hear our thoughts on the original two as well. So you've got the whole saga here.
Yep, we've covered it all. I think we are done. I think we can put this franchise to bed.
I think so.
It feels good. It feels like we've accomplished something this year.
It does. 2020, yeah. 2020 actually came out with, you know, something positive.
Yeah, absolutely. Anything is possible. All right. Brandon, I want to thank you for joining me tonight. Yeah. I'm glad we've been able to take this journey through the Godfather films together. I think we've talked about this offline, but we haven't said this publicly, but I think maybe our next classic/guilty pleasures franchise crossover might be the Smokey and the Bandit films.
Yeah, I think it's time. Yeah, we've gotten to the point now where Eric and I are getting really good at doing two a month. So yeah, so Smokey and the Bandit, definitely.
Mm-hmm. And it's the inverse of the Godfather, where the first two were classics and the third was a guilty pleasure. In this case, first one's a classic, last two definitely guilty pleasures.
That's true.
So. And in both cases, the third one goes real off the deep end.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. No. But yeah, he doesn't have the most shining filmography, but I am a Burt Reynolds fan. Mm-hmm. So I think he's very underrated. So
absolutely. So, all right. Well, what else you got coming up with classics?
Well, as at the time of this recording, we just dropped our classics episode on The Great Race from 1965. Really fun comedy with Jack Lemmon, Tony Curtis, and Natalie Wood. Big sprawling comedy, good to watch with your whole family over the holidays. So that's coming out. And then Eric and I will also be dropping a year in review episode the week of New Year's.
Awesome. Very cool. All right. Yeah. And, you know, guilty pleasures, we hit Christmas hard. We did a trifecta. If you're still in the Christmas spirit, or maybe you just missed these movies and want to catch them the first time, we did a trilogy of Netflix originals. We did Princess Switch 2. We did Christmas Chronicles 2. And then we did Dolly Parton's Christmas on the Square, which is really the crown jewel of
it's a gem.
Yeah, of not only those three films, but maybe of those three podcasts that we did, but all of them were great. I had a lot of fun doing those, so you can go back there. We got a lot of cool stuff coming up in the new year for Guilty Pleasures. I don't know when things are going to drop when, but I just looked at movies that are celebrating their anniversaries. 1991 was a year, let me just tell you folks. Mm-hmm. So if that's enough of a tease, please make sure you go over to the Guilty Pleasures feed and subscribe so you can not only get our main feed shows, but also our feed exclusive shows and catch everything that we're doing. I also know of something we said we were going to do into December, but I think we're punting into January, where we are going to do our Survivor Simulation podcast, Survivor Movie Heroes versus Villains. And the time couldn't be better now that everyone's watching Survivor Heroes versus Villains on Netflix. So come on board and just simulate a season of some of the most iconic movie characters of all time. If we can pull it together, it'll probably be a Facebook Live event as well. So you can find that by going to our Facebook page, The Front Row Network, which has links to all of our shows, classics, flashbacks, guilty pleasures, full disclosures. As you're listening to this, I believe we have just dropped the full disclosure on Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. And I know we've got full disclosures coming up with Soul, Wonder Woman 1984, and then all of the big prestige movies for the Oscar season, which is going to be ramping up post-haste after the first of the year. So keep in tune to all of that. And also, if you're interested in getting even more content from the Front Row Network, please subscribe to our Patreon. You can find us over there under the Front Row Network, where you can be a subscriber and get access to all of our shows, but also some exclusive content, including some bonus episodes and even some trailer reactions. I just did one on the coming to America, which still feels weird to say. That trailer that just dropped for the sequel to Coming to America that's coming out in March, you'll get my reaction by going over to that page. And in the meantime, you can follow me on Twitter at the fake blue hair or at Front Row Reviews with a Z. Brandon, anything else? Where can the people find you?
Well, my social media is not too exciting, but I do have Front Row Classics does have our own Instagram page, FRN Classics Pod. We also have our own Facebook page, Front Row Classics Podcast. We put a little movie trivia there every once in a while, and if you want to request a movie for us to do, that's great. I welcome it. Go ahead and do that as well.
Excellent. Well, that's going to do it for this episode. I want to thank you all for listening. I hope you do check out Mario Puzo's The Godfather, Coda, The Death of Michael Corleone. I had to say it one last time. But more importantly, I hope you had a happy holiday season. I hope you have a wonderful new year. I hope we all have a great 2021. I hope we have a much better 2021 than we did 2020. Hope you're staying safe, washing your hands, wearing your masks, taking care of each other, and enjoying all the content we have coming up for the Front Row Network. So until next time, for the Front Row Network, I'm Lou Hare.
I am Brandon Davis.
And as always, we'll see you in the front row.